Chink death, who is gentle, it's almost a sweet interpretation, letting go. So listen to that first.
Pre-read, Kate?
No, just follow the words so you know what's going on, that's hard enough. The singer is a German called Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, who's a very famous lyric tenor. He is very Germanic. What kind of feeling did you get at the end of the song when death was singing? Emotions.
Resolve.
Starts out that the person is very scared, and by the end it's just same notes going on and on and on. Other
things? I thought of it like a seduction, so the way he changes his voice when he was singing about death and the words
that he did a lot of what we call voice painting with the tone of his voice, how he lowered it and he made it sound more peaceful and round. Okay, that's a very formal kind of composition. There are certain rules that you play along with, and you would sing this kind of song on a stage. The next song by Edith Piaf, singing, Man is Following Me in the Street, has to do with her life, from puberty to maturity and death. Life is an irony. The idea conveyed in this song is that the men who follow this girl in the streets at several stages in her life are always the wrong kind of people, a disgusting old man, a policeman, and finally death to her funeral. So it's very hard to read, I know, but you can see what they copied it off of. It's really hard to copy. I'd just like to read a little bit about Piaf. She was called the Sparrow, and she took the stuff of ordinary life and wrought a hymnal for the man in the street. Piaf, the frail woman who stood up different, ignoring the sugary love songs to give us songs that were different. Piaf, really not ugly, simply unattractive, except for that voice. That voice that was the only thing she ever had that was really beautiful. Nothing seemed to indicate that the poor little blind girl abandoned in the streets of Paris would ever become the grande dame of French popular song, but miracles happened, and Piaf became the Sarah Bernhardt of the most unlikely kind of song, the chanson des rues, the songs of the streets. Never heard on stage, heard in the streets. When Piaf appeared, minuscule in her black dress, you forgot everything you didn't like about the way she looked. Listening to her raucous voice sing those words of desperate love, those stories of affairs that were bound to fail even before they started, those romantic loves that had to end tragically 9 times out of 10. She convinced you the songs were important, and because she had suffered, bits and pieces of her own life came through again. More than a singer, she was an actress, a great actress who was able to communicate her inner passion because she knew from personal experience the desperate things she sang about. So this is a totally different view of death, and I'd like you to take a few minutes to read down on the translation so you know what's going on in these different verses.
Decided that what might be a really good idea, since we've heard from several people about how, gosh, I specifically have heard from several people that I do much too much talking, and that perhaps since I am just merely another participant in the class, why does everybody else have to wait for them to get a number in line, and why do I get to jump in whenever I want to, then maybe what we ought to do is turn the entire class over to be led by one or two other people. In which case, Kate and I would just be other members of the class wishing to participate in order as determined by those leaders. So, we decided what we were going to do is make sure that the last person who came to class today would be the one responsible for leading the class today. So, Tom, the discussion on illusions is yours. I do hope you have your notes ready, and you are about ready to ask very provocative questions to get us all started.
Okay. So, what do you think of the book? Theo. Theo, what did you think of the book?
I liked it.
Why did you like it? You're trying to finish the book?
No, I'm trying to.
Come on, we don't have all day. Why?
I like the way it portrays to the, like, what would happen if, you know, the Messiah, a Messiah came today, and you met him like this. It's like, hi. You know, start talking to him, and after, you know, the shock, what it'd be like to be a modern day Messiah. I mean, the way he uses the, and how people really don't listen to what you're saying, what is said sometimes.
Go ahead. Didn't it also would kind of imply that perhaps we were the modern day reluctant messiahs?
Did that bother anyone, the way they seem to give anybody the title of Messiah, something that we generally thought of as belonging to one person? Christine?
I don't know, I kind of wondered about it and felt kind of funny about it, but then on the part where at the end of the Messiah's handbook it said everything in this book could be wrong, then it didn't bother me very much anymore because it was kind of even as our choice to believe it or not.
Just like some books and books have good things and bad things in them. One way or another. Mm-hmm. What didn't you like? Are there any specific points that really grated against you?
I like how the way the book says, you know, the thing you have, we're all metaphors for God. Every little God's in us. How it's all inside. How it's not something that is done. How Don kept telling Robert that, you know, you have it, it's in you. I think that's what everybody knows. It's there if you want to believe in it.
A lot more positive outlook on life in that, like Hale mentioned, try being a fictional character, and you can see that you're more than just a human body or the people that are working 9 to 5, that's a choice they're making, but it's not a choice you have to make. Just on and on, don't be afraid of opportunities because maybe there's something you can learn from, which is not, I don't know, that's not what you hear from your parents a lot of times and a lot of other people that you listen to when you're growing up.
Well, just in that, keeping that in mind, kind of reminded me of some of those PMA books you might read. In a sense, plus them in line. But
I was going to say, it seems to me that now this book is kind of directed as more to ourselves rather than to our society. In that sense, I don't see it kind of like as a positive mental attitude, but just it's just that I think that some of the stuff in the book might be kind of negative to some of us, and that's why we would accept the people where we're going.
How do you think that? Kind of like when it showed an example, I can't remember exactly, but how if you tell yourself that you can't do it, you're not going to be able to. And you need to tackle it and say, yeah, I can, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it up that stupid tall hill, whether my skis are going to make it or not. But, you know, you got to, because I can see you, you get this negative attitude, it doesn't help you at all. And that's what I got out of the book, partly, is that it kept on saying that, you know, it's an illusion. And you understand?
Also, something along that is, when he always made mention of you already know everything, it's just a matter when you're taught of learning that you already know it to start with. And kind of like you're a whole person to start with. You don't need to try to be one.
I think you have a good question. It's called illusions. And I think, why is it called illusions? Is it what she said, and what? I haven't thought about that. Why does it have this title?
What do you think?
What does it say? Freaking zero. Why do I think it's a? Oh, that you know, our limits and what we. The structure we put on the world is all an illusion, and if we can get beyond that illusion, we open ourselves up to a much greater potential that all our limits in the world.
Or maybe is it that not if you get beyond the illusion, but if you increase your illusion to include whatever you want it to? I don't know. I wasn't clear on whether he was saying you could go beyond the illusion or just create your the kind of the most limitless illusion that you want. I wasn't sure.
I think it's both. I mean, say the world's illusion, and also you can, you know, you can, since they're all illusions, you're like a magician in a way. You can create your own, like creating a blue feather or, you know, creating whatever else you want.
Anybody think that it went too far? Sometimes it making you think that you could, you know, make a blue feather. I don't know how many believe that we can actually, if we want to, think of blue feather here and it'll come here, or that it went too far in saying that we can do anything we want to do to others those kind of things.
I feel like it just kind of used those really way out examples to make us think that we can do it. Because those are really far out, and you know, we don't really think we can swim the earth. Most of us don't. But it makes other things seem more possible to us that we really can control and change and make decisions about.
Is that PMA stuff I've heard? Like, I heard one guy use an example of just starting small and using a parking, getting a parking spot. Because when you go to a parking lot, believe that you will find a parking spot and look for it. A lot of times you put blinders on and you can't see things. And if you look for it, you can find it. And then you begin kind of playing this little game, and soon you're able to quickly spot perfect, you know, parking spots and right by the doors, things like that. But if you believe you'll be able to get a good parking spot, that you're more likely to get it. Or more likely, if you don't believe, you won't get it. In that, but he was saying that if you look for a blue feather, then you'll probably find one. But if you don't look for one, you won't find one. You can create in your mind a picture. If you see yourself doing something, it's very likely that you'll be able to do it.
When you said, did you think that he went too far in talking about what he could do to other people? Are you talking about the freedom thing, that freedom isn't you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt others? It is freedom because you can do whatever you want to do. Is that
right? And when he said, you know, the golden rule is wrong.
Part of my reaction to that was that he's right. I mean, the golden rule doesn't have to be right. And all it is something that we've put on ourselves so that we have a little structure to go by. But it's not right. It doesn't make it right. Freedom doesn't have to be that you can't hurt others. That's just what we've done so that we keep ourselves from hurting others because we think that's bad, but that doesn't mean it's right.
So basically, this book is amoral. It doesn't have any morality because, according to this, if you want to kill somebody, sure, you can kill somebody, but it's not going to hurt them, of course, because you can't hurt this other person. Only that person can think they're hurt. So it's okay to murder somebody, and if that person thinks he's hurt, it's his own fault.
That's
what it says.
Just a thing. Okay, so but
think?
It doesn't have to be wrong because it's amoral. I mean, it doesn't, but it does, I think it does have morals for yourself. It does say you have to be the best person for yourself, and you have to be true to yourself and learn what is there is to learn about yourself. And I think that's moral. But just because something's amoral doesn't make it wrong. I don't think we need to always have this guide about what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, I was thinking of the instance in the book where the lady called up home when he was in the radio station, and she was going, well, can you say, you know, that everybody can do what they want, you know, this world is full of evil and sin and everything, and if everybody did what they want, you know, the whole world would go wild. And I guess I see basically that there's, for me anyway, that they have two different ideas of human nature. One is that inside, if we're allowed to do what we want, we're just going to go crazy and kill everybody and, you know, just play rape the earth or whatever. And the other one is kind of like, if you let people do what they do, they're not going to really choose to do that.
Exactly.
Or if they do, it's not going to be as wide-scale destruction as she thinks it would be. And she goes, well, what if everybody did what they wanted in this world? And he goes, this would be a lot happier world. You know, I just think, I don't think they're both wrong, I don't think they're both right, but I just think they have different views of human nature.
What does it mean to be Messiah?
Really deep question.
Sorry, Tom, it's your question.
What does it mean to be a Messiah? See, I was thinking in question.
And
I was
actualized in my mind.
Trying to figure out one.
I like the beginning of the book where he was free writing in his little journal. And he was talking about how that one little microbial in the river was in the side because he just let go.
Isn't that a cool analogy?
Yeah, I mean, it's just
at the very beginning.
Surrendering control again.
I think on number 7 in this sort of gummed up beginning, it says, so it was that he went into the countryside, and people following began to call him Messiah and worker of miracles, and as they believed, it was so. So based on that real simple definition, a worker of miracles, someone who allows the miracles to happen for everybody.
And also that maybe you aren't necessarily a Messiah, but other people
whatever you believe is true.
If we want to be a Messiah, we can. If we don't want to be one, we don't have to.
Well, but here's the definition of Messiah for, or filling me by different definitions. Remember, we did look it up. What does it mean to be a Messiah? What are you saying you are? You say you're the Messiah. You say Jesus Christ was the Messiah. What does that mean otherwise? One of the definitions, if I remember it, was something like almost like a secretary in a Messiah's kind of like a, I forget it, it's been a while.
Aside from the definition.
I can't hear.
I think instead of
Todd. Moving forward and talk the same volume.
Okay. First I think we need to stick with the definition from the book. And also we need to remember it talks about being a reluctant inside. Why are we really reluctant to be follow the is and to be? We can't be.
Besides, their definition of miracle.
They're saving someone from something. I mean, there's Messiahs that save everybody, or there's Messiahs to save themselves. And if there's something that they need to be saved from, whether it be their self or ignorance or sin or whatever.
So miracle working to save her?
Even Don mixes up the words Savior and Messiah when he's talking about the title to his manual. You know, he says Savior, and you know, the other person says Messiah. And maybe he said that because there's a difference in the two. Maybe that was part of the misunderstanding.
To me it also seemed like Messiah, how he meant it, was coming to a point where you're free to be how you are, just by yourself.
You usually think of Messiahs as having some sort of mission, but does that go along with the way you can do anything you want, and you can change anytime you want? Do you really have a mission?
You have a mission to do whatever you want and to change whatever you want.
Your only obligation in any lifetime is to be true to yourself. Being true to anyone else or anything else is not only possible, but the mark of the faith is that.
And also, when you talk about being moral from the book, I suppose you have the option to murder someone, but
the effect I got was if you are a messiah, or if you totally accepted yourself, that wouldn't be something that you would want. You would want to. You'd be happy within yourself.
There's also something, for me at least, about being a messiah is that they're sort of a teacher. If you're a messiah for yourself, you're learning. You're teaching yourself something important, something about life, like Don and Richard go through and Don never tells him, usually doesn't tell him the answer, but he's sort of a facilitator. He's kind of encourages it. Richard is the one who teaches himself or uncovers that he already knew. And so now he's the Messiah. And there's also the little things in this book, little sayings, maybe they're for us to be our own messiahs, for us to learn. So part of being messiah is being a teacher and a learner.
Basically, I don't know, I'm speaking for myself. And my view as a Christian is that I'm a follower of Christ. And as a follower of Christ, it's part of my belief that He is the Savior, the one Savior, that I can't save myself, that Christ is the mediator between myself and God. And by His death and resurrection, I am then saved, because through that act, I was saved. And just basically that doctrine right there.
Yes.
That means then is that we need to, in order to stand up to our own beliefs, to be more tolerant, and listen to what not the words are, but what the implications are. So getting back to what illusions is all about in that same kind of context, then since we're talking about some of these very same issues, then in the last part of the book, it says everything in this book may be wrong. The Bible doesn't exactly have that qualifier on it, so we can't talk about it in that sense. So what does that mean? What do you think Richard Bach is saying when he says that? Annette and then Kathleen.
It made me think that, boy, you have to take everything as grain of salt, and you have to really decide, hey, is that right for me? Is that how I believe? Because I know, like, when I left the Lutheran Church for a while and I went to a fundamental church, you know, sometimes you take things so literally. And when you hear that, and then it's like, oh my gosh, then shoot, I shouldn't even be drinking at all. But you know, I didn't think I was really harming anybody. And then you just have to sit, and that's just a small example. But just saying that you really have to decide, is that how I feel? Is that really honestly me, or is it somebody else? You know, and I'm just thinking that no word is so strong. It's just that little oil that's on that piece of paper that used to be a tree. You need to put it through your mind and your heart and decide what you want to believe in, what you want to see in it.
Okay, one last word. Let's try and keep our conversation zeroed in on illusions as much as we can. Kathleen, I think you were next.
Okay. I think it's saying that his box and the whole book view of reality as being just an illusion is an illusion, that this book is an illusion, that the illusion is an illusion.
Which we can create by ourselves.
And that even it puts the book inside the book, within the reality it created. It kind of allows you to attack or view the book the same way that you view that it views the world.
Okay, let's take that even further. Let's see if we can understand that then. If we say that everything is an illusion, including the book that might be an illusion, if you extend that out, what are we talking about? Isn't that sort of a paradox?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then let's take that. What does that mean? What is the implication about that? Go ahead, Matt.
Boy, I'm lost. Could you go back to the book being an illusion and explain that?
What did some of you feel about that? A lot of you brought that issue up.
The book being an illusion?
Yeah.
I think it's the most wonderful part of the book. I think it's the first book we've had that doesn't hint you towards any direction the whole time. He says, try this, don't try this, it's all your choice. And then when he says, this could all be wrong, that's what makes it so wonderful. You decide for yourself and challenge yourself by what it says. Responsibility when you read some of those things and think, I've made these choices. No one made them for me. I made it. My life is how it is because I made these choices.
Are you getting closer to what it's all about, Nick? Can anything answer Meg's question a little better?
Well, this is doesn't have to do with your question, but it's responding to
it. Well, go ahead first.
Well, I agree in part, but I disagree too. I think this book gives you the illusion that it's trying to let you think whatever you think, but I really think it's very manipulative, and I think it's making you think what the author thinks, and kind of just like he made, Don made the author feel kind of stupid when he got off track, I think it's doing the same thing. I think it's trying to make you feel stupid if you don't understand that it's all illusion, and it's trying to make you, I think there's a lot of good things that it's saying, but I think it is not leaving it as open-ended as we might imagine.
It flits between reality and fantasy, and there's no clean line.
It doesn't really flip between reality and
for
fantasy.
For it all being illusion.
I see what you're saying, except that you keep saying the book and the author make you think that way, make you feel that way, and they don't. You decided to think that way about the book. And
that's
it's
what
like
the author
what
says anyway.
True, but it's kind of like what Lori said about interpretation of what something means to Brent and what something, I think I just read it from a whole different kind of viewpoint to start with.
Nobody can make something feel a certain way. It's you that, it's how you interpret it, what people say, and it's you that makes yourself feel that way.
Maybe I should say the author is trying to make you feel one way. He's trying. I think the book, kind of tries to, in a way, to make you feel a little, if not stupid, ignorant, if you don't understand the things.
Tom, maybe you, one of the things I think that's real important about it is that why can't the author just express a point of view without being accused of having to try and make a person do anything? It's sort of like
it's so powerful.
It's the way he does it.
No, he is making an art form. From my point of view, what he's doing is not making anyone do anything. No one has to buy the book except for the fact that it's recommended for the class and you had to read it. Essentially, what he's saying is that here's my point of view. He even says it in the book, here's my point of view, take it or leave it. But some people feel like they're being made to see something in a way that they're uncomfortable with. What I think is important about there is not that anyone makes anybody do anything, but that it's such an important issue and says something powerfully in a way that you're not used to hearing it, that you're uncomfortable with something about it. He isn't making you do anything. And I think just like somebody else says something in class isn't making another person feel anything, Richard Bach isn't making you do anything. I think what you have is a good point about whether it's manipulative and how he arranges his point. I think that's really valuable, and your reaction to it is really important and valuable and genuine. But whether Richard Bach is making you is sort of the point where we start parting ways on that thing. Think about that a little bit, and we can talk more.
Don't you think in the book, the way it kind of comes into these questions, it kind of backs into them, and before you know it, you're kind of thinking, this fits with everything?
Well, of course, it's a book. It's not, it's his version of philosophical statement. He's going to say it in a way that is most convincing. You know, is that wrong? Should he make his own personal statement really kind of badly convincing? Just to, you know, if I wanted to make a point, I'd want to make it as clearly and as wonderfully and as convincing as possible. If it makes sense to you that way, then good. You can either accept it or not accept it. So I think to accuse an author of manipulating you into feeling something is not giving yourself enough credit.
I agree with Tom that he tries to make you feel, if you choose to read the book, that he tries to make you feel like so you're doing something wrong if you don't believe that. And I see you sitting there going, oh, well, she just won't accept the way that I'm doing it and what I say is right, but you're trying to make us all believe that what you say is right. I really think you are. You're sitting there and you're making it sound like what Tom said.
No, I don't think that's what I'm doing. Maybe that is what I'm doing. What I'm trying
maybe
to do...
Maybe that's what some people perceive as.
Okay. But what I think I'm trying to do, and maybe not doing very well, this is a good point, is trying to empower you to be able to make your own decisions without having to blame someone else for making your decisions for you. And from my perspective, when I see someone or feel that I am saying one person is making me feel a certain way, I'm realizing that implied in that is I have no power over feeling my own way. I don't have any response to be able to say no. For whatever my reasons, which I don't have to know about, I reject that point of view. No one makes you feel some way. I understand manipulation, but I just look watching the television. I see manipulation all the time. There are people trying to make me eat hamburgers, smoke cigarettes, want to get skinny, blah, 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 blah. But I can identify it, and it can be, I don't blame them for making me because I have the power to not watch. Think Kai and Theo.
I think what she's saying, if she feels that, maybe she feels that things make her feel that way, and then she feels that you're telling her that she's wrong because she feels that way, and that just your point of making people feel that way, that you're trying to convince us that that's right, and maybe it is. But maybe her point of view is that books make her feel so way, and you're telling her, no, look, nobody can make you feel any way.
It's just like the sex in the slides that we saw.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying. Ultimately, we have to accept each other's point of view about it. And I don't deny the feeling. That's the thing that people misunderstand. I don't deny that you feel that way. I don't deny that that the feelings you have are valid. I don't even deny that this book has something to do with exposing some of those feelings. The point that I think is real significant in terms of self-empowerment is to realize that nobody makes you feel.
What if someone feels that...
That's what you feel.
Yeah, that's right.
What if I feel that this makes me feel this way? Are you going to deny that it, you're telling... You're saying is, I'm wrong that it's making me feel that way.
No, I don't know.
If
what
it,
I'm saying,
it happens, it works, and it's there. I mean, if you're manipulated into doing something, I mean, you're saying that even though you're manipulated, it doesn't mean it's true, but we just... The book says if you believe something, it's there. So what you're saying is it's you're doing it the way I'm doing it, you're doing it to yourself, and you're saying it's not real then, when it really is real.
I feel like
when you say this book made me feel something, it's like you're saying you're putting all the blame on the book. You know, I think maybe that's what Lori's saying, is that the book doesn't make you, you know, it doesn't say, oh, believe this, you know, it's coming at you in the head. I mean, it's like, you're there reading it, and, you know, sure, it's persuasive, and a lot of its concepts and things. I think everything in the world's, in a way, persuasive. But you always have the option to say, this is persuasive, but I don't have to buy into it. It's my choice to do that. And it doesn't make me do anything. It's my choice whether I want to agree with its arguments or not. That's, again, maybe that's what Lori's saying. I don't know. What do you both use it?
Well, I don't deny what you're saying, but you're wrong.
Okay. I'm
saying,
wrong.
No, actually, I don't feel like that way, but that's the way I get the feeling that the author is saying, and sometimes Lori is saying that. And I know they're not trying to, but it just seems like they are sometimes.
They?
Like the manner that
other people, I mean. I don't know, it's just, I guess you can't voice your opinion if your opinion is different from someone. You can't help but, you can accept their feelings, but you still kind of, in the way you say it, say they're wrong.
So the differences really matter, huh?
Restate that? I think you have a good point.
No, I'm not going to restate it.
Hey, why? Do you say what it means?
that there's nothing to matter.
I don't even know where that came from.
Yeah.
I don't know, I feel like my point was missed when we went back to the first level. That I wasn't talking about the stuff in the book how to affect you. I was talking to meta level of how, of Lori, okay, first we're talking about the stuff in the book, and you feel that you can feel any way you want. And let's say I really believe that the stuff in there makes me feel this way. Hypothetically, that I feel that you're saying that we're wrong, you won't accept that we can feel it. What? That...
I won't accept that you can feel what way?
That you can feel that I really believe that this makes me feel this way. I mean, I'm not saying I feel this way, but I feel like what Kristen said is, I feel this makes me feel this way, and I feel like you're telling me that that's wrong. And that's exactly, you're projecting, in a way, it's a second level. You're telling her, well, look, you can feel however you want. If she can feel however she wants, then she can feel that this is making, or not, that she can believe that this feels that way. And that you're saying, no, look, you can feel any way you want from this book. It's not making you do anything. You're
maybe
telling her
she's
wrong, almost. And that's how it's coming across.
Okay. I think that's very well stated, which is sort of the paradox that I was getting around to before. Before Meg wanted to have the idea of illusions defined. And I think that that is precisely what the book is about. And although I'm going to have to leave the definition behind. Yes, Theo?
Oh, just want to restate what exactly the book's about.
We're sort of getting into the paradox of what illusions is, which is, I think, why it sometimes is confusing to people, which is precisely the paradox that Kai was talking about, which is... If everything I say is a lie, okay, which is just what he says in the book when he says everything in this book may not be true, what does that mean? Remember that back with geometry and theorems and all? Remember all those sort of basic ideas of setting up logic? What is the paradox in that statement, everything I say is a lie?
If it's a lie, then...
What you're saying
is
true.
Spock
did that on
your
mind.
Yes, I was
thinking
that. Exactly what I thought.
Okay, which is precisely what the paradox of the book is about, which is precisely the point that Kai was saying, is that the belief that I have is self-exclusive if you take it to a logical alternative. But on the other hand, if everything is an illusion and everything is arbitrary and it doesn't really matter what it is anyway, then what's the only solution? The only solution is your own personal point of view. The only solution is to have your own self, develop your own ideas, and be who you are. And if that's what it is, then if that's what the world is anyway, then why not, if everything is an illusion and all that you have is your own version of that reality or that illusion, then why can't we accept that in other people?
The differences,
which is precisely what that whole little argument was about. Why is it we have to invent rules to make everybody else believe exactly what we want them to believe? And what does Richard Bach have to say about that?
He's very clear on that issue.
He says it, yes, repeatedly in the book. What does he have to say about that? Whether he uses the voice of Don or himself, or anything else, what does he have to say about that issue?
About allowing people to make you believe what they believe, or...
Do you want me to take that sort of train of thought again? I think it's fairly clear. Does everyone understand what I said?
Could you go through it one more time?
Yeah,
go through it.
If everything is an illusion... No, we're not trying to say whether it is or it isn't. We're just accepting the premise of the book right now.
If it be.
Okay. If everything is an illusion, then there is no reality except the reality that we choose to invent. Okay, we got it so far? If the only reality is the one we choose to invent, why do we spend so much time imposing our reality on others? Okay, how does Richard Bach answer that question in the book?
Well,
some quotes?
Sure, go right ahead.
Can I read some quotes?
Yeah.
Page 154, 155 of the Gospel. Well, comma, Donald, comma, part one. I do not exist to impress the world. I exist to live my life in a way that will make me happy. Okay, part two. Part two, everyone else is free to do whatever they feel like doing for a living. Part three, responsible is able to respond, able to answer for the way we choose to live. There's only one person we have to answer to, of course, and that is ourselves, Don said, replying for the imaginary crowd of seekers sitting around. We don't even have to answer to ourselves if we don't feel like it. There's nothing wrong with being irresponsible, but most of us find it more interesting to know why we act as we do, why we make our choices, just so. Dot, dot, dot. Page 155. He goes on to this explanation, and he says, way too long. Okay, how do you hope to impress the world? I rolled out from under the plane and rested for a while in the shade of the wings. How about I allow the world to live as it chooses, and I allow me to live as I choose? He threw a happy, proud smile at me, spoken like a true Messiah. Simple, direct, quotable, and it doesn't answer the question unless somebody takes the time to think carefully about it.
How about if I choose, or how about I allow myself to choose how I want to live and allow the world to choose how they want to live? Okay, what about protesting nuclear war? You're choosing how you want to live by protesting it. Is that really allowing somebody else to choose how they want to live by building bombs? You're saying that you're telling them that what they're doing is wrong.
Well,
the other one
but,
is not.
But
the,
you have to.
The thing is,
to do what you
you're
want
building
to
bombs. It's your money. It's your country. They have no more right over the military than you do. And that your military is building your bombs. And you're saying, I don't want my military to build my bombs.
But some people are saying, well, I do want my military to build bombs. So, if and there's just, you know, that's just one example, but there's a lot of things we say that, you know, sure, you can say, I'll allow myself to live this way, and I'll allow you to live how you want. But in living the way we want, there are times that we're telling them that they can't live the way they want.
Like,
I mean, just like by the bomb, by, you know, saying, you know, saying, well, I'm not going to let you drink my blood. I mean, we're living the way we want to. We're not going to let him drink the blood, but we're not letting him live the way he wants to. So we can get to all these, you know, we can say, you know, live the way you want, and I'll live the way I want, and that's great. If that could work, that'd be wonderful. But the only way it'll work is if we all want to live the same way.
Is that really true, though? I think that'd be worth.
Now be
well, it'd be worth really sort of debating a little bit. If we want to talk metaphorically, you talked about the vampire. If the vampire has to live and survive by drinking someone's blood, and you don't want that vampire to drink your blood, then maybe that vampire won't be able to survive unless it can convince someone to let them drink their blood. What might be a way of doing that? That's certainly something to think about. But if a vampire has to survive through the death of other people, and maybe that vampire won't be allowed to survive, not because he's evil, but simply because nobody wishes to sacrifice. Or maybe there is somebody who would be willing
someone
to.
Someone else. No one.
It just isn't you. And I think that's part of what the idea is that you do what you can for you and let everybody else worry about themselves. In terms of what I think is a somewhat spurious argument in terms of the nuclear weapons issue, is that that's sort of so far down the line that it seems to be a real cut and dry paradox, but if we kind of track it back, we can find that it really isn't. For instance, if everybody in the whole government, or this whole nation would say, okay, those of you who wish to support nuclear weapons can end their income tax, pay the appropriate bill, and those of you who don't wish to support nuclear weapons can take the same amount of money and earmark that for humanitarian needs, how many nuclear weapons would be built in this country? And then what does that mean? Does that mean someone else's rights are being infringed? No. It means that everyone gets to do what they want to do. And what the implications are for that is basically, I think, in ultimately a more Christian life for everybody. We stop and think about it that way. And that means that everyone has that choice. And what the implications of that choice mean are that it starts filtering down to an interpersonal level instead of way back over here about some issue that's so hard to touch and so hard to look at that we sort of just let somebody else surrender it to somebody else. To me, what I like about the book is that the choice is brought right back down to you and me. And that if we keep the choice back down to you and me, the choice up there will also change because the nature of the reality that we share changes. The questions change so drastically. I don't want to monopolize
the realities change.
I just don't see how it can practically work. I mean, there has to be somewhere along the line where you say, you know, well, I'm going to sacrifice something for something else. I mean, it's like saying, well, I choose to live by you giving me all your money. That's the way I choose to live, whether it be right or wrong, that's the way I choose to live, and I don't want to change it, and that's my choice too. Okay, now, what happens when you say, I choose not to give it to you?
Well, I think that your first point is one where the flaw in the logic is you choose to live your life, but you can't choose to do something with my life. So if you choose to lead your life by wanting to take all my money, you can't do that unless I choose to live my life by giving you all my money. In which case, the two of us can get along fine.
But I choose to live my life by telling you how to choose your life.
But that's a power over my life, not a power over your life.
Well, that's what I choose. I mean, I know it's wrong. I know I'm just playing the devil's advocate because...
You're talking about part one without the part two, basically.
What's part two?
Everyone else is free to do whatever they feel like doing. Responsible is able to answer for the way we choose to live.
See, that's saying we have to choose part two. What if in my life I don't choose to let everyone live the way they want to live? It's kind of like that's what's happened throughout history with people like Hitler. And
I follow you. I follow you really clearly. What happens if everybody else sort of says, yeah, you're right? It's sort of like, you can choose whatever you want, including choosing to take my money, but if I say no, I that's your choice, but my choice is different. Find another sucker. Then you either have to conquer me to take my money, which I can choose to let you do or not, or you can convince me or find somebody else. The point being that even if you want to take the difficult metaphor of Nazi Germany, is that Hitler couldn't have done anything unless people bought into it. People said, yeah, I agree. If people would have said, you do what you want, but I disagree, there would have been no Nazi Germany.
But then he wouldn't have been allowed to live the way he wanted to live.
He would have been able to, for himself, try and do whatever he wanted to do for himself. See, the implication being that
I think I can make a qualification. I choose to try to live the way I want to, and I choose to let you try to live the way you want to. Does that make...
That's sort of the best we can do, so without thinking it any further, that sounds good enough. Meg had a point, and I don't want to kind of belabor this, because we could continue talking about this for a long time, which I would love to do. Meg?
I was just agreeing with Tom, that I see this whole idea as just being impossible. There's no way you can live your life without interacting with other people and having to make decisions and not have everybody run around and do what they want. I mean, I remember even doing exercises, I'm sure everybody did in school, where you make picture the world with no rules, or picture the world where everybody wanted, and you know what kind of things you came up with at that age. And now that you know how much more complicated and how much more people interact, I just see it as really impossible. And this is off the subject, but I was thinking it's also just seeing the way the difference between you and Tom think, that that's probably why you kind of feel quiet just from last week's test or whatever.
Wait, I'm confused about that last statement, Meg.
I was just in here thinking that Tom
thinks like a thinker, and you are more an imaginary
feeler.
Yeah.
Does that mean that Tom and I can't coexist?
Yeah, but it's just kind of cute.
Yeah, it means we can't coexist. And my point is that there's plenty of room for the Toms and the Lauries in the world.
Yeah, I know. It's just that it's kind of cute.
So what? Question to the chair. What is being said, or what has been brought, spoken, I mean, is that because the ideal is not practical, then it's not worth anything, right? It's not worth talking about life where everybody gets along, where everybody lets everybody do what they do, because that's not how the world is.
You have something to do.
Am I reading too much into it?
Well, I think that's one of the things that we're talking about.
That's why he brings up the lady at the TV station. That's why he brings up the vampire.
Where's the vampire?
Kai?
I think we're looking at it, okay, today everybody's going to suddenly, okay, you can do anything you want, and then you might think of something wild or something, and you try to imagine this world, everybody's running around and suddenly feels that there's no responsibilities, but I think that it, you take it a step at a time. I kind of relate it to this, the thing about, there are some people who, there's a question sometimes with people who really care about wildernesses or something, and they, you know, urge people not to buy as many material things or something because they have to go in mining more things or something, and then so they kind of cut back a little bit on what things they have, and the other people say, well, look, not everybody's going to give up their toaster oven, so it's not going to do any good, and so everybody buys everything that they need anyway because it's not going to make any difference. But it's not going to happen. Everybody isn't going to stop doing it one day. But if people start doing a little, it's going to help anyway. And the same thing, if just through this group of 20 people go out and start acting more what we want, it doesn't mean what we want is going to be. It's going to be a progression. Of a Christian's image of everybody turning Christian or something, that it's not, nothing's going to happen overnight, and being ourselves doesn't mean that everybody's going to be different, and it doesn't mean you're not going to be able to communicate with people, have relationships, you still will, you just learn to do it differently so you can still stand up for yourself, and you can, and start to accept the way they are, and that, I think that,
Well, according to the book, we are already living the way we choose, because if we choose to be unhappy, what we are, if we choose to work on our life and choose to say that I didn't have any choice in my life, that was our choice to be able to say that. So according to the book, you know, we're already, you know, like you said, there wasn't going to be any big change, you know, we're already in that situation.
Maybe the part of the difference, though, is being aware that you're being aware that you're choosing to live like that and not being aware that you're choosing to live like that.
Because some of the people that called in on his when he was on the TV or radio or whatever operated so much out of fear that they couldn't comprehend anything he was saying anyhow. It just whished right by.
To me, it seems like the whole thing is getting way more complicated than it needs to be. I mean, it seems like people are going to be different, and people are going to have to be able to accept other people. We're going to have different views, and we have to be able to work with other people, talk with them, and meet each other halfway. I mean, be able to understand honestly what the other person is thinking. I mean, last night, Tom and I were so mad at each other. We were yelling. We were both crying. We were furious. I mean, if we had left then, we wouldn't be sitting next to each other right now. And we sat there, and we talked, and we cried, and we hugged, and everything's better. And if people could... It seems like everything is getting so much more complicated. I mean, it seems like cooperation and talking and understanding other people is the whole basis. And I don't know why everything's so complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yes.
You're right, but I think there's times where you can't talk or communicate. Like, I don't know, like, the thing with Hitler. I mean, do the Jews really have a way they can communicate with Hitler and say, hey, I don't want to die, I don't want to be gassed?
What if they all get together?
And
but I think the issue about that one is that it wasn't just the Jews, it was everybody. And I think that's where the problem comes in any kind of a situation like that.
If you're not going to win, does that mean, therefore, you don't have a voice? I mean, do you have to have positive results to say something?
That's right. Did Christ win?
Does it devoid your argument if you don't, if you're repressed?
And then you were trying to say something before.
It has to do with what Michelle said, and I'm just putting in another statement, I guess. With all these people on this earth, and you know, supposedly we're supposed to all be out there living to be who we want to be and totally us, that life involves a give and take process. I mean, you've got to leave room for it. Maybe you don't have to leave room for it if it's not you, but you face up to the facts that maybe you're not going to be able to reach all what you're looking for.
It seems to me that what we're looking at is that we don't. Do we believe in evil or do we believe in peace? It seems like we believe in it. We live with fear. We put all these defenses up, like the government puts defense because they're afraid those people are coming in. If they took them down, maybe it wouldn't be bad. If we had to take our defensive down of you being different, that we're assuming that there's going to be something bad. We're living in fear. We're believing that people are evil. And if we could somehow lower that a little bit and in that same way be open, be ourselves, really believe in peace. Do we believe in peace or do we believe in evil? That people are going to be evil if I say, go ahead, kill me if you want, or you know, or something like that. We don't believe in peace. That's why we can't.
I really kind of agree with what you're saying, Guy. Because I can talk about the same thing with Lori about this. And a couple things really stuck to me after our talk. One was that he said something like, correct me if I'm wrong, or elaborate after I'm done or something, but like through the history of mankind, force to change people's beliefs has never worked. It never has. Force has never worked. And the other thing is that like discipline, like when we watched that movie on how to make Marines, discipline in a way probably creates more evil than the opposite. In other words, I also remember this one 2020 story where this junior high kid, his dad was an ex-Marine, and he's always telling him, go get grades, beat up kids that beat up on you. And then his principal was on him, and his teachers were on him, and nobody listened to him, and they were just all telling him what to do. So he just blew up one day and went through school shooting people up. And so I guess I can kind of see that point. That kind of
just to say that ended up just 2 weeks, right? We say we want peace. Everybody has that. I don't know what everybody's definition of peace is. But in a sense, it's everybody being able to do what they want, being friendly, not having all this stuff. But then we say, well, look, it's not practical. In a sense, we're saying peace isn't practical. It can't happen, so it won't, you know. And, you know, it's a big thing. Everybody says, of course we want peace. But do they?
To go along with what Kai said is, yeah, it's all nice and dandy to say, yeah, we need a give and take, but there's people who aren't going to give, and there's people who aren't going to take. And they kind of...
What would Christ have said about that?
So therefore, you can't give and take. If people aren't going to give and take, then, well, they're not going to do that. I'm not going to do it either. Gosh, I don't need to step down.
But it could kind of destroy the, you know, that person's not going to give, that kind of leads you.
Does it qualify?
It destroys you. So, but at least you tried. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but maybe the assumption was wrong, and maybe that person would have given if you had given to them, maybe. And if you don't, then you're stopping the process and not them. And I think it ties into what Kai's saying about believing that peace is practical versus ideal. I mean, if we're constantly setting limitations, you know, but what if that person doesn't do it, it'll mess up the whole thing. Well, at least try, because you aren't going to end up any better off for, at the end, going, well, I knew that was going to happen.
I still would like someone to answer the question that I asked. about this. There you are in a situation, and you know that if you do what you think is the right thing and the other person isn't going to listen to you, it's not going to have any effect. And in fact, they might even try and jail you, repress you, or kill you. What would Christ do? That's right. The point being that all of us are stuck with the idea that it's me that counts. And I think that if you really are yourself and delve deep enough, you'll realize that it isn't you individually that counts. It's all of us that count. In which case, if you need to help the world, if that's the way you look at it, then you need to be able to live your beliefs. In order to live your beliefs, which is what Tom was talking about, Tom Witt was talking about when you were talking about nonviolence, is it's really scary because the implications of that are enormous, absolutely enormous. You're right, Michelle. It's very simple. It's so incredibly simple that the implications are vast. And so when I think about that, and I think about how we are often personal kinds of cowards, not that we have to convince somebody because they have to believe what we believe, but that we're often afraid to convince them by living what we really say we believe. That's what I think the illusion is about, is finding where you are and living it. Living it to the best you can, knowing full well you're in a world that may have a current that's crossed. But what's the risk you take? The risk is that you get to heaven. Tom.
So I'm not disagreeing with you, but implied in that, and this is something that I would like to believe, but implied in that is when you choose to live your own life and when you choose to believe the things you do, you choose to be willing, there's something that you choose to be willing to die for them, and that's a choice that's almost universal. If you want to choose to live your life, then you have to choose to die for them, so there is one thing that you have to believe.
The question I'd like to ask about that is, what then is the difference between somebody who, say, is a devout believer in Christ or peace, or a person who is a neo-Nazi who is willing to die for their beliefs as well?
When it gets scary, you change the definition. So you can still be safe.
Elaborate on that, Kyle.
I think that's what, okay, think this thing about prison, maybe. If you think that standing up for something that's important is, but then they tell you, well, you're going to be put in prison for it, then you're not going to be wrong, because that's what they're telling you, and you change your mind so it fits what they think. And then immediately you've lost that part that you believed in. I think that, it's really true what he's saying about living people. I have such a doubt of what people say in a sense. If someone tells me something, I'll throw it around and almost won't listen to it. I'll re-gauge it and throw it out maybe. And the thing that I get from people most, what I gain the most, is from people who witness, from people who just live what they believe, and then I see that, I respect that in them, and I go, man, look at, he doesn't care whether I believe what he's saying or not. He's living it, and then I go to him and I want to learn because I see him living it, and he's not forcing anything on me.
That's your Messiah's
difference. For that moment, for that thing maybe, that if I respect somebody, it's almost because they're living it. And I really try to do that too. I try to, if I think something that I really think somebody else might be interested in seeing in their point of view, I'll try to maybe inspire them to see it from that point of view, and I'll plant the seed, and if they don't look at it, I'm not going to waste my time. I'm not going to let them hurt me. And so I'll go on. But that's the way I try to witness. The things I believe, I want to plant seeds where I don't think people see things, but if they don't want to see them, I'm not going to take the time to water it.
I think it was Lori's question about if Christ had a, how do you say that? Anyway, and how we agree that he would do what will instead prison north. And that kind of goes back to something I was thinking about the book before the break. I think. And that if Christians are supposed to live life of, like Christ, as we follow his example, which was a Christ-like life, then aren't we all supposed to live like Messiah? Because he lives what we think of as Messiah. And how can we live his life and not look the part of a Messiah? Isn't that kind of saying, well, we'll live his life, but we won't be a Messiah in that?
In a way, I think you're supposed to be a Messiah, but yet, again, you have to get to this definition of terms that what is a Messiah? Is a Messiah somebody that you see and you kind of look at and, well, like Christ, he did all these things, okay, and we're supposed to look at and apply it to our lives. And then we do those things, and then others see that in us. And so in a way, we are being like a Messiah. Because they see Christ through us, or what we are doing that Christ did, and so on.
For me, I had a little trouble defining Messiah, whether it was we're supposed to be godly messiahs or worldly messiahs.
Want to clarify that for you?
Well, maybe a worldly messiah would be somebody that would
like a master or a teacher.
Well, let me give you the other one. I think a godly messiah is someone who's a messiah because God or God works through that person to heal or whatever. And a worldly messiah would be someone who read a messiah handbook and learned from it and taught it and lived it.
I can see what
you mean. Could God be working through that book?
Well, for me, it's, you know, there could be only one Messiah, and not everybody could be Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So am I, that's why I kind of have to struggle, because worldly Messiah, like to say, okay, yeah, I could be a lot of work, you know, those Messiahs, but if it's God's Messiah, I guess, in my mind, I can only think that there's two ones.
Yeah. You think of ourselves using the old word metaphor as metaphor messiah, meta-messiah? That we're not the, you know, every side, I think the problem I see I can have with using the messiah is thinking that people are the messiah instead of just the, being the messiah, but being a meta-messiah. Small part of the whole.
The way I see what Jay is saying is I think that I have a good idea of what I want to do for people or what I want to do for myself and of doing good things, and that if I do that and, you know, do things for people that are good all my life, that's in a sense a worldly messiah, that I'm just doing it because of me. But suddenly if I look at it as if I give up my life to God, I'm doing the same things, but I'm giving God the credit, that that's the godly messiah. That I can still do it because I'm doing it for God. And I can say, yeah, all these things are great in you, why? You know, and then you can say, well, you know, I just love you, you know. This is great, I'm doing it because I care about people. Or I could say, it's God's love, he loves everybody, you know. And I have trouble with that sometimes, because sometimes I wonder, you know, what's the difference? Is it just me and the belief? Am I going to act the same way? So, I don't know.
I understand what you're saying, but I guess the point I was trying to get at is, I think of Christ being Messiah that he was perfect. Or I kind of weary of saying perfect, but in a way I think that, you know, Christ has this aura around him that he was very, very godly. That's the godly. And that we as humans, you know, Christ as human, we have that same sinless perfection that Christ had as Messiah.
But in that term, you said Christ-like, be Christ-like. That's what they said, be Christ-like, not be Christ. Be Christ-like, be Messiah-like, be God-like.
Life not complete.
Well, we're illusions. We're illusions of God, so we can't actually be God, but we can be like.
And
we can wear his image, so we can be like God. We can be like Christ, but we're images.
So if you put Messiah like in all the places in him instead of Messiah, is that thing okay? Because you're trying to be Christ-like. That okay? That makes it not the same.
Loudly, God.
I've gotten 6 stars out of it. When you delve deep enough into yourself, you realize that not only you that matters, but also others around you. And it seems that that's where this business of godliness versus the worldliness. Christ came and he knew exactly what he was all about. And it was not him that mattered what he was all about. It was the other people around him that mattered. He died for our sins, but for everyone else, not for his own sins, but for the Christian religion. It seems that's what, if we all see within ourselves that desire, that spark of divinity, whatever, and I'm not seeing it, put myself on the same plane as Jesus, but, you know, Jesus. So, according to our Christian belief, Jesus was man. He was one of us, so we are one of him. But at the same time, yeah, we're still, I'll back out.
I don't know, it sounds to me like now we're going full circle and come back to when I started the whole thing. So, the difference between Christ and me. So, anyway, I just like to read. Page 48, one of the problems where I have problems, and maybe this can open it up again, I don't know, but whatever. Yeah, page 48, you're talking about John being Messiah, he kind of quit being Messiah, and then he goes, well, yes, John, but seems to be finally different from other jobs, you know? He's going back to hammering nails for a living? Maybe it just sounds odd. You consider that kind of scheme or something. I don't see your point. The strange thing about that is he didn't quit when they started calling him Savior, Captain Rat. Instead of that piece of bad news, he tried logic. He was like, this supposedly he was talking. Okay, I'm the Son of God, small s, but so are we all. I'm the Savior, small s, but so are you. The work that I do, you can do. Anybody in their right mind understands that. And the problem I had was, when Jesus says he's the Son of God with small ass, and he's the Savior with small ass.
What I'd like to say is that, do we know if Jesus put the capital or if the translators hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later put the capital on?
Well, that, I guess, it's not just that, whether that's the Savior has a big S, but then I think of all the other times where Jesus says, but his exclusiveness or inclusiveness to himself, saying I'm the only begotten Son of God, you know, and the voice in heaven is baptized and all that stuff. I mean, there's lots of things I can back it up with from everything, from my belief, from dogma, from scriptures, from other Christians.
Okay, all I'm trying to say, I'm not saying which is right or wrong. I'm just trying to sort of say, okay, I understand where you're having a problem with it based on one point of view and another point of view, but not wanting to sort of mix them up in some way, can we see what he is saying by that statement, what the implications are for that statement? So rather than looking at words and compare words and juggle words around, let's even figure out what the heart of each statement is and see if what we understand of the heart of one and the heart of the other actually can be mingled rather than be more like oil and water. So what is he saying with that statement?
I feel like he's saying, he includes the idea that I'm a child of God, and so we're we all. Okay, and I can go along with that. And yet, I say that Christ was more than a child of God, because of my belief. Okay. expand upon that?
Yeah, I would say that he is God. He was God.
Mm-hmm.
He is God.
Mm-hmm.
So, Leon.
So with that saying,
right.
So are we all, right?
Yeah, but you disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
That we are children of
Christ.
Isn't Christ also a child?
Because, I think because of Christ's humanness, he was a child of God.
Mm-hmm.
And yet because of his divinity, he was God. Yeah.
So what?
See how it's not so simple after all?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that the problem here is that we always sort of start zeroing in on all these little nitpicky kind of things. And my point is that we can always get nitpicky anytime we want. And nitpicky is one of those things that's sort of like saying, my skin is just a slightly different shade of skin than yours is. Who's got the right kind of skin? Primarily, I think what's more important in situations like this is to sort of get at the heart of the matter and not worry about the nitpick. And in this case, what they're really talking about is not really so different. There are other things where they don't exactly measure up. One person's focus is slightly different than another. But the heart of the matter is if this person ran for president, I'd vote for him. If you ran for president, I'd probably vote for you too, because I think in some ways, you're not really all that different. And so what I'm trying to say is that let's not focus on the differences, let's see if he focuses on the similarities and see how far that gets us.
Yeah. Yeah, see, the only thing that makes this weird for me is I'm a Christian. Obviously, if I wasn't a Christian, this, even using an example, wouldn't bother me so much. Okay. Other than that, the message I'm getting out of it is that Jesus and his message applies to us. It's not like because Jesus was Jesus, he was above us and away from us. It's that he was a child of God and so were we. That the work that he can do, we can do. And
so we can work miracles as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that. I believe there's nothing that he's done that he can't do in his humanness.
So why can't we all be God?
Because that is not his humanness.
I said his humanness.
That is
that's my qualifier as a Christian.
That's
okay,
his
if you're a Buddhist, then you would say the same exact same question.
Yeah, I think his book is more than Christian. I think it's more inclusive than that.
See, the problem is he uses Jesus as an example. And I think because of that, he's not sticking to the traditional or the dogmatic view of Jesus. And so people that do hold that view show a lot of people. It's going to, you know, mix up some people. But the main message I think is that Jesus said, you know, you can do the work I can do and even more. So that the work he did, he says, if you amount with the faith of a mustard seed, you know, here the exceptions. They say it's imagination. I mean, like, I totally agree with all that.
Yeah, there's something else that I think is bothering people, and that is that this author is saying that you don't have to suffer for others. That you don't have to make a major sacrifice. All the people might press on you to heal them or feed them or do the miracles, you cannot live the life of one other soul. So what at the end of the book they say, well, you know, what is it all about? And he says, be happy. Be the way that brings you happiness. Rather than being the martyr. Number 32, see if this doesn't affect you a bit. And the master said unto the silence, in the path of our happiness shall we find the learning for which we have chosen this lifetime. So it is that I have learned this day, and choose to leave you now to walk your own path as you please. Honor to be hanged, glory to be nailed to a tree, and burned, if so be that God has asked, said they. And the master said, forget it, be happy.
Well, if I'm happy being nailed to a tree.
So
what if I choose to nail to a tree?
So what would you do if God spoke directly to your face and said, I command that you be happy in the world as long as you live? What would you do then? And I think that's very major point that's also contradicting to a lot of beliefs.
That's a good point. And I think that Jesus is the person who made that possible. Jesus is the person who did have to suffer for all. And then he gave us, by him being the one who suffered for all, none of us now have to suffer if we choose not to. I think that he is who made it possible for that to be true. And that's the way I see it. I see that.
Yeah, people are free to reject that.
So what I'm saying is, by his suffering, Jesus made it so none of us have to suffer, because the debt has been paid, so to speak. So none of us, there's no interest payments that are still left.
But you also said if we choose to. There's something else.
There's something I said, well, if we choose, we can choose to suffer or choose not to suffer, but Christ gave us that choice.
What I'm saying is that there are people that won't even choose the person that Christ suffered for all.
Right.
Therefore, what are you talking about?
But you just said some people won't suffer for all. Therefore, you had an assumption after that, and who cares if some people won't suffer for all?
No, I said Jesus. Some people won't believe that Jesus suffered for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, in a way, I mean, you can't force them and say, you got to believe Jesus Christ suffered for you, and if you don't, I'm going to shoot your head off, you know?
Okay, so
you could, but it's not really going to help that person.
We're still getting way off the point here. Yes, go ahead. But I want to get back to
you. I understand here, but I sort of just tell that this subject, I mean, this book has really been related just around Jesus Christ, and that's fine and everything, but if we're going to get to the heart of the matter, like Lori was saying, why do we have to keep coming back and relating it to that? I mean, can't we just talk about the book? Maybe it's impossible. No, I don't know what the conversation was before I came back. So that's the
good book.
No, I think that you're right, Lisa.
But I don't know how to do that. I mean,
I think it's part of the book. While we're talking about different, you know, you do what you want, I do what I want. I thought we had a good discussion on that. Now, I felt like we were coming back. I just felt the whole discussion coming back to kind of like when I brought up sitting in this morning. I really noticed that.
Okay, what about
so here we are discussing.
What about on the first three pages in the very beginning, the abstract of the book, so to speak, the cleaners and the one that got pushed by the current and let go and surrendered? What can you use that as a takeoff? What happened? What did the cleaners think of the person that was flowing along, doing your own thing?
Oh no, he made a big mistake. He still was gonna die.
What else?
He was jealous of him, though.
Then they thought, what else?
Yeah, they thought he was great, but they weren't willing to take the same risk.
Okay, and what did they call that person that got swept off?
The Messiah.
Okay. Then what happened?
They left and they made a big story about it.
Let's see here. They made legends. They cried the more. He said, "No, you guys can let go too. I'm no more Messiah than you. The river delights to lift us free. If only we just let go. Our true work is this voyage, this adventure." Number 20. But they cried the more, "Savior," and all the while clinging to the rock. And where they looked again, he was gone, and they were left alone making legends of the Savior. And it came to pass when he saw that the multitude thronged him the more, day on day, tighter and closer and fiercer than ever they had, when he saw that they pressed him to heal them without rest and feed them always with his miracles and to learn from them and to live their lives, he went alone that day onto a hilltop apart, and there he prayed. And he said in his heart, "Infinite radiance is, if it be thy will. Let this cup pass from me. Let me lay aside the impossible task. I cannot live the life of one other soul. Yet 10,000 cry to me for life. I'm sorry I allowed it all to happen. If it be thy will, let me go back to my engines and my tools and let me live as other men. And the voice spoke, go thy way as other men and be thou happy on the earth. And then they get into, but, you know, what happens, you know, if you tell us to suffer, should we suffer? And he gets into, you know, should we do the torture no matter how difficult the task? What about all this suffering? What does the book say about suffering? What does the book say about, should you do something that somebody else tells you to do? Hurt.
No. Things do you do what you want to do. People tell you to suffer, and it's just what suffering is.
And how do you feel about that?
Could you say that again, David?
From what I gather from it, it's just, but first when he said that, he said, I'm no more Messiah than you are. Just, you know, it's saying, I'm no better than you are, I'm just being myself, and you can be yourself too. And then when he talks about suffering, there's no reason to, not any reason, but if you don't want to suffer for others, you just look at yourself.
Okay, so how do you feel about that? What's your reaction to that statement?
I mean, there's an instance in here where, you know, the lady on talk show says, Scripture says, by the sweat of thy brow shalt thou earn thy bread, and sorrow thou shalt eat it. And he goes, we're free to do that too if you want. Like, we're free to accept what we want. We accept what it says in the Scripture is happening. But she's free to do that, to obey that. That comes for her choice. I think in a way there's something keeping her from taking that, her own choice. Maybe it's society, maybe it's something else. But just by the fear that she's giving off, it's like she's not doing what she wants to do. She's doing what she wants to do.
And then she wants everyone else to do it too, since she can't do what she wants to do, no one else can do what they want.
Because I suffer.
So must y'all. So what does that mean? I mean, there's a part of us that always thinks that suffering is good, that we can't be selfish, it's hard to give to ourselves, it's hard to even, we're afraid that if we do what we want to do, we're going to go out and rape and pillage. What is that about?
I've done that my whole life in my family, tried to save all the other people from the hurt, help them make their lives better, and it doesn't work. I mean, I found it doesn't work, and now that I'm trying to change it, that isn't working either, because they're used to me being the little person in the family who's the social worker and who's willing to go out of her way to help everyone else, and that's one part of the book I can really agree with. It doesn't want to be
alive
that way.
We don't think it didn't happen.
No, because they didn't face a lot of things they should have faced themselves.
You think you're helping somebody out when you really, I have found that I think I'm helping somebody out, but really I should have let them be on their own because they would have grown a lot more.
But don't you need to suffer for other reasons?
Oh yes, I've thought that for so many years, Kate. But now, and if I'm in the same boat as Kathleen, whereas now I'm trying to change that, and that doesn't work either, so it's a hard road to walk either way you go.
To just be yourself.
Yeah.
But also, just because, I mean, if we do see somebody that's having a problem, and we think that by sacrificing something, by suffering a little bit, we can help that person, then that's not saying that we're a masochist because we're accepting a little suffering, and that's not, doesn't say that we accept suffering for everything and for our entire lives. But, I mean, this goes along with what Michelle says, I mean, I think. Because, you know, but a big part of things is based on relationships and interacting with other people. And there can be, I mean, if you ask Mother Teresa if she was suffering, I don't think she would say that she was suffering.
No, she'd probably consider herself in marvelous ecstasy.
Right, and she probably is in marvelous ecstasy. I think that, I don't know, I just...
Well, let's do a down-home example. What if someone in this class is crying, and I come up to them, and I try to suffer for them? What's going to happen?
No, you don't have to try to suffer for them, but you can go up there and hug them, and you might feel a little bit maybe uncomfortable or embarrassed. I mean, it might be the easiest thing to walk out of the room and completely forget about it. But just because you go up there and just hug them and be with them doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, you know, you might consider, well, yeah, it's uncomfortable, but it's not so bad.
What if I need to suffer for them?
You can't suffer
what?
For them. I don't think anybody
you can suffer for them.
You can suffer for them.
Can't, what these people are, I think you're right, you can't, you know, you can, can't you help somebody in the same ways without suffering?
Well,
that's what,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It seems like we're saying if we help them, we're taking their suffering. I think you can help people and just
yeah.
throw away both the suffering.
I wasn't saying that by, suppose it was helping someone that I was suffering,
but that's what we're saying. We're saying, well, look, we can't, I can't help you because the suffering, my suffering from them doesn't help, but you can help, and if they throw hurt or suffering on you, just, I mean, that's where you don't accept it, I think. It doesn't mean, okay, don't. It seems almost like, well, it's not worth it to help them, what I can do.
It's, I guess, getting back to how we're helping them, whether we're helping them with an attitude of, I will stop this person crying because I don't want them to feel pain, which actually cuts them off from facing what it is they need
right.
to get to in themselves. That is not a very Christian act, trying to alleviate their pain by taking it on for yourself. But that's what we do. Your intentions are great, but it's forcing you into a mold of not being yourself, too.
What if, I don't know, this is really relating to me. I think it's hard for me because I don't think a big part of me is trying to help people, and that's where I get my kick. And if I can do something, but I don't suffer for them, and I'm not trying to make it so, hey, everything's better, but somehow I try to maybe just inspire them to look at it a different
yeah.
way or something.
It goes back to what David is saying, if you are living it and you don't need to suffer for others, you just see yourself in that.
Maybe it's like someone's hurting you and you need to help. Look at yourself and comfort them, whatever, do what you can to help them. And yet, if it does happen that in order why you're doing that, that it's going to take some suffering. Not because you choose it, you say, oh, this is the best way for it to happen, but just because it's the way it happens. I think you should let it be. I don't think you should say, oh, I mean, if it's going to take suffering, then bye. I'm not going to help you.
Or I'm
but in the same way,
I'm
going to say, I'm only going to help you. The only way I can help you is suffer with you. You know?
Jump in that if you have to.
I think two kinds of suffering. There's suffering where a person needs to have the suffering, this pain, so they can grow through it. But there's a kind of suffering where, like, maybe a person's in physical harm. Let's say they're in a car accident, there's nobody around for miles, and you're in a hurry to go to a movie, okay? But dang it, you feel, I really need to help that person, okay? I'm going to sacrifice getting in that movie, but this person might be dying and I can help them. You're suffering in that way, but just leaving that person there to get over the pain is not going to be helping them either way, but maybe helping them because you have a nurse degree and you know what to do is. There's two different kinds.
Christ didn't suffer and die for the heck of it. I mean,
That's a profound statement.
Anyway, I mean, he jumped on the grenade. I mean, a person, if I see a grenade and there's a bunch of people around, I'm not going to jump on a grenade because I'm thinking, oh, hey, I'm going to suffer. All right. I'm jumping on the grenade more because... Because I choose to do something for another. That doesn't mean that I choose suffering for others. I choose others, and suffering happens to fall and be a part of it. I don't know. That
the intention of your actions is for the others around you.
When you go out to help somebody, are you going out to help them because you think that there's a way that they can be that would be better, or are you going out to help them just so that they can become whatever they are? For instance, let's say there is a person who you have this sort of feeling that this person is going to turn into a mass murderer. This is a child now, and somehow you get the feeling this person is going to become a mass murderer. Here's a person who needs your help, who needs you to give something to them. Will you help them just to go out because of love for another human being, knowing full well this person may slay you later on? Or do you help this person in an attempt to keep them from becoming that mass murderer?
Maybe in that situation, you do see it and you think that maybe something you can do can inspire them not to do it. But if not, you know, you gave it your shot. And if you don't, you maybe be suffering more for it. If it's someone who happens to be close to you or something, and you don't do something, it's easy to feel...
Murdered.
Yeah,
guilty.
Yeah, guilt if they do something that, not prevent from hurting yourself, but you prevent... I guess, I think that it is, in a sense, you think that they could look at it in a different way, which might be better for them, and I'm
so
not
in other words, what you'd be doing is you'd be manifesting your love out of expectation of changing that other person.
Not expectation of changing them, but expectations of inspiring that they might choose to change.
I'm not sure I recognize the difference. What I'm saying is that most of us, suffering for me is part of the process of going to help somebody through expectations of them changing or evolving or becoming something other, of having an impact on
them. That's suffering.
I think that suffering stems from that to a degree. And what I'm wondering of is how many of us are capable of being able to give simply because of the act of giving, not having any expectation, not having any, they could slap us in the face and we would turn the other cheek. How many of us can give with that kind of love? How many can give without having any expectation, no matter what we might like to have happen? They have no expectation.
Even the expectation of suffering.
Even the expectation of suffering.
You want a number?
No, I just have a question.
Not very
good. Yeah.
What if you don't use expectation, but you use, what if it's a care for somebody that, not that you're expecting them to change, maybe it's not because you want them to be like you, but because you think that, teaching is, or is being able to show them something that they already know. Don't tell them, hey, this is the way to be, but say, hey, this is the way to look at the way of being. I don't know. That if they're going to take it or leave it, and if they leave it, that's fine, and maybe...
Getting back to illusions, I think that this issue is precisely one of the things that makes the book be what it's about, is that what it is about an accepting kind of gift and lovingness that now is not only manifest toward others, but is also manifest toward yourself, which is the sort of a message, I think, is difficult for us to hear.
Can you say that again? I'm sorry.
For some reason, I can't remember the exact word. What is it called? The way mothers love their children with no
reservation.
Unconditional love. This is a book about unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
Unconditional love does not have morality. Unconditional love does not have laws. Unconditional love doesn't say that it happens only at night or only during the day or only in the morning before I go to work. Unconditional love is something that happens all the time. And what makes unconditional love so incredible is unconditional love is given without having any expectation. In fact, if there is any expectation, it's the expectation of not getting anything back. Unconditional means just what it says, unconditional. We do not understand most of the time what unconditional love is in our lives. When we think about what Christ did, Christ manifested unconditional love. In this particular book, what Richard Bach is talking about is that issue of what unconditional love means if you extend it into the way you live your life.
And to yourself.
And most importantly, to yourself.
Do you have any expectations of any of us through this trust for this class?
Well, I'm certainly not Jesus Christ, so I'm not perfect. But in some ways, I have the only expectation that I may have, if I have any, is that you go about and become more of who you are, and that's an expectation.
Is that an okay expectation?
I think it's an okay expectation because I have it, but that doesn't mean. But that, do I give you unconditional love? Well, in terms of how I respond to each of you, in some ways, I care about you. I care about you whether or not you have beliefs that are like mine or not. And it doesn't matter to me if your beliefs change. So in that sense, within a limited confine, we all can give degrees of unconditional love. But when we go out to help somebody else, I'm not sure we operate mostly from that point of view. And it's a question. I'm not having an answer. I'm just giving a question. Now, I frankly think that's why this book is awkward for some people, because it extends the whole concept of unconditional love into the way we view primarily ourselves and how we can't do that.
We're in a knowing situation in some cases based on our beliefs. We can feel guilty because we're doing something for ourselves, or we can feel unhappy because we're suffering and giving to others. And this book sort of blasts you right out of that into another world.
And everything it says may not be true.
And anything Lori or I said may not be true.
I have a question off the subject. If we have out of assignment due on Wednesday, when do we still understand when we're all going to be in?
Wednesday.
On the syllabus, it said you were going to get Wednesday off. Sorry.
Okay.
Wrong. Don't trust what you do, even if it's on Wednesday. We changed our mind.
I have one, we're drawing this to an end here, and there's one issue I think that's really important. There's a lot of themes that this book brings about in this very simplistic way. And one of them is the idea of self-empowerment as opposed to force. And I think that although the book doesn't spell out those issues, it really talks around them in such a way that we could really address that. And although we only have 5 minutes left, and I don't want to talk about it now, what I'd like to do is talk about it tomorrow. So I'd like you to just sort of write down in your notes the self-empowerment versus force. And I'd like to be prepared to talk about it in two ways. One, how it relates to illusion. And two, how we can extrapolate that and how that relates to our own lives. They're two very different issues. Today we sort of wound around those two things together, what illusion said and how we responded and how we feel. And tomorrow I'd like to see if we can just divide them a little bit just for the sake of argument.